Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott. Scott Horton, that is. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Good show lined up for you today. Barbara Slavin's going to be back on the show, writing for Al Monitor. She's got the scoop on Iran's proposed nuclear deal. And then also I recorded one this morning with Amy Hagopian on the dead Iraqi civilian study. It came out earlier this week. So that's pretty good, right? Oh, man. I went to take a drink of my cold, cold drink, and it's gone. Not only is it not cold, it doesn't even exist. Oh, well. Commercial break's coming up. All right, well, hope nobody sues me for playing that whole song. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Thanks very much for tuning in. We're on Liberty Express Radio. LibertyExpressRadio.com, 3 to 5 Eastern Time weekdays. Also at No Agenda Radio, ScottHorton.org, Anomaly Radio, and I don't know, some other places, ARS Radio. I think they just do the replays, not the live show there. And then, you know, I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, most importantly, ScottHorton.org. That's where you got to go and click on ads. I swear, I got this part of my brain that wants so badly to, revitalize ScottHorton.org, not just post the show there, but start writing at the stress blog all the time. And you think about, you know, those of you who are my Facebook friends, well, I don't know, Facebook, I think, hides all my posts from everybody, so maybe they don't know, but anyway, I do post all damn day on Facebook, and all that stuff ought to be going on stress. I really want stress to be, that's at ScottHorton.org, that's my blog there. I really want that to be the center of gravity for what I'm doing on a regular basis. I really need to get back into that. But anyway, I will. God dang it. I am at ScottHorton.org right now, at ScottHorton.org/chat, actually. Got a few people hanging out in there. We got the chat room now built right into the website, so if you want to join up and hang out with the boys and also not say or write anything, then, you know, you could do that too. ScottHorton.org/chat. It's the quietest chat room in the Western Hemisphere. Anyway. So the best news in the whole world is the prospect of a nuclear deal between the United States and Iran. And like I was saying, Barbara Slavin is going to be here because she's the reporter who got the scoop about what, in fact, the Iranians proposed. And sounds good to me. As she points out in the article, it does not satisfy every one of the West's demands, but then again, they're all unreasonable. Well, that's just me. That's not her reporting. That's just me. But anyway, she's got the scoop. Very important, very well done article at, in-depth, substantive article there at All Monitor, so be happy to talk with Barbara Slavin again about that. And then this morning, I talked with Amy Hagopian, and that's about the civilian deaths in Iraq. Was it, as the Lancet study said, almost 700,000 as of 2006? Or as low as 500,000 as of 2011? I don't know. Nobody knows. It's hard to tell. Obviously, if the Opinion Business Research study that estimated 1 million had died as of the beginning of 2008, and then the truth is, no, it was only 500,000. Or maybe even 500,000 is a little bit high. Maybe it was only 300,000 civilians died in the war. Then, yeah, so I don't know. How many hundreds of thousands, how many tens of thousands of innocent lives lost before your project, whatever nature, becomes illegitimate? I don't know. You tell me. Anyway, talked with her about that. I think it's got to be in the high hundreds of thousands, probably near a million, 600,000, 700,000, something. I don't know. There was horrible war there for a long, long time. And, you know, I actually misstated my own case in the interview. You'll hear it where I say, I guess I just kind of thought the overall deprivation would have been responsible for more deaths than the combat. But that's not really what I thought. Or maybe one part of my brain thought that, but there's a whole other part of my brain that already knew that, no, most of this violence was from the war, from the militias, and from the U.S. Army. I mean, they did kill a hell of a lot of people over there. There's a whole book called Collateral Damage by, edited by Chris Hedges and Layla Al-Aryan. But it's just the stories of American soldiers, and I shouldn't say it's just edited. It's Hedges and Al-Aryan. They worked really hard to try to verify these stories as much as they possibly could. They reported these stories as best as they possibly could to verify what they were being told. It wasn't just, some kind of nonsense. But the whole book is really written by Iraq War veterans telling their stories. In fact, the way the book is divided up is, night raids versus sweeps versus convoys versus checkpoints. And, all the different categories of killing. That's a hell of a lot of people killed in that thing. And I guess at least the American people recognize that they got nothing out of it, right? Even if, as Hagopian says in the interview, they quite unfairly, according to the opinion polls, believe only about 10,000 Iraqis died in the thing. Can you believe that? Is that really right? I mean, I know it's right that polls say that, but is that really right that that's what people believe? That only 10,000 people, only 10,000 innocent people died in that war? When it's got to be hundreds of thousands. That don't seem right to me, man. I don't know. But, the government, the media, they're liars. So, it's not like they ever told the people the truth. Hey, everybody, here's the real truth about what we did here. Since, you put the American flag sticker on your car bumper in 2002, too, dude. We remember. Anyway, they never had a honest appraisal on TV, so I guess, how could the American people know? It's not like they're going to read about it. So, it's classified that America even had a war in Iraq. Oh, war in Iraq? Yeah, I don't know. That was a long time ago. Nobody cares about that shit. Well, anyway, I asked her. I'm ruining the whole interview for you. I asked her. So, previously they thought almost 700,000 dead as of 06. Opinion Business Research said a million. Double check, too. Did the entire study twice to make sure in 07, 08. And they said a million people had died, comparing the excess death rates from before the war and after. So how'd you get only 500,000. She says, well, we're sure that 500,000 must be a conservative estimate. A lot of the people, as soon as somebody in their family dies, the rest of the family goes ahead and gives up and leaves. So they're not around to answer the question. Anyway, I'm not a commie and I'm not a conservative. So I don't believe in collectivism. And I don't believe in collective responsibility, only individual responsibility. Which I'm very happy to, dole out and judge as though I'm God himself. I have no problem with that. and have no problem doling out and assigning responsibility in 10,000 little pieces to everybody responsible for one big horrible thing, if that's what's necessary too. But I don't believe that the people of America are guilty for the Iraq War. Just half of them. So, you know, if I was a Pat Robertson born-again Christian, then I would say that God is going to, or maybe I would cite the economy or whatever crisis, and I would say God is punishing America, or God will punish, because, man, there's a hell of a lot of sin here. There's a hell of a lot of guilt, a hell of a lot of responsibility to go around, and that does go for the fooled. If you're over 18, then you have no excuse for believing a lie a politician told you. No excuse. If you're 17, then you're an idiot. You don't know anything. Shut up and do what your dad tells you. If you're 18, sorry, you're an adult. It's your responsibility. And everyone in the military who went along with it instead of going AWOL, they're responsible. And everybody in the national security state who helped target people to die, they're in on it too. Oh, and MSNBC and CNN and all of them. All the cheerleading that they did. All of the passing on of falsehoods as though everybody knows that they're already fact-checked and double-checked and double-verified to be true. They're all responsible, too. But, you know, that also goes for your cousin Larry or whoever who couldn't wait to see the U.S. government kill Iraqis even if he didn't volunteer to go help do it himself. There's some kind of responsibility there. It doesn't seem fair that the American people don't even have to. And that's the guilty and the non-guilty. Well, the not guilty, it doesn't matter. They don't. It's not. It is fair for them. I don't care. But for the ones who cheerled for the war, it's not fair that they don't even have to recognize the consequences whatsoever. That they're allowed to just continue believing that only 10,000 people died in that thing, probably, and that's not that many to accomplish whatever noble goal that's supposedly accomplished. You know, the creation of the Islamic Republic of Iraq. In fact, think about how many Americans have died of natural causes peacefully, surrounded by their loved ones and family members since 2003 in this country, who were guilty of cheerleading for that war and or participating in it, and who never had to face up to the truth about it or admit any guilt or responsibility for it at all. That doesn't seem fair, especially when the lowest level soldiers are the ones who they take responsibility in the hardest way. When you look at the suicide numbers, you know, when it should be Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith slitting their wrists, when it should be Donald Rumsfeld hanging from the banister, it's some specialist who actually had to go through the motions of doing their dirty work and who now can't forget it. Who ends up blowing his brains out or crashing his motorcycle at 130 miles an hour or finding another way to kill himself. 10,000. Yeah, 10,000 died in the first few months of the thing. By Thanksgiving 03, 10,000 died. Kidding me? Anyway. So Amy Hagopian's going to be on the show. That's my introduction to later. I'm going to play for you this interview that I recorded with this lady. But first, I had to, you know, hector you and moralize and insult you and carry on. I tried to get Joy Gordon on the show. She's the world's number one best expert on what the American sanctions did to Iraq 1990 through, well, now, but really, as far as the book is concerned, through the time of the invasion of Iraq, the Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton blockade, and Bush Jr. blockade, too, where that killed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people as well. I forgot if she goes as high as a million in there. I don't think she disagrees with the UN estimates of a million died in that one, too. Just the blockade. You know, the thing of it is that Iraq, they just had all that oil money, so they were able to build up a pretty big population just on oil money and on imported food. Genghis Khan had salted the earth, the Fertile Crescent and all that was destroyed 1,000 years ago or whatever, right? So it's kind of all desert now. So they imported their food that they bought with their oil money. And then Bill Clinton just took all their oil money away and starved their entire society to death. Half the people that died in it were children. And as everybody knows, the Clintonites bragged about how big deal. So what? Let's see, do I have that clip in here? I might have that clip in here somewhere. Let me see. Madeleine Albright. Where are you at, Madeleine Albright? Nah, it's somewhere else. Anyway, you've all heard it a million times now. Worth it. Anyway, Joy Gordon, she wrote a thing for Foreign Policy about the Iran sanctions this time. The human costs of the Iran sanctions. I tried to get her on the show, but she says she's buried deadlines today and just can't do it. I did interview her about her book, Invisible War, which, by the way, Anthony Gregory reviewed for the Future Freedom Foundation. So if you search FFF, Invisible War, you can read the great Anthony Gregory. And Andrew Coburn, the great journalist Andrew Coburn, also reviewed the book for the London Review of Books, and it's called Worth It, that Madeleine Albright quote. Is the title of the essay there. If you want the Cliff's Notes from Invisible War, there you go. Anthony Gregory and Andrew Coburn both reviewed it. And anyway, so this is, again, the human costs of Iran sanctions, and it's about how the Iranian economy has been brought down by the Americans, and how, of course, the poorest and the weakest, the youngest and sickest and oldest and most helpless are the ones that suffer the most first. And a big part of it is they don't have a gigantic pharmaceutical manufacturing infrastructure in Iran. And it's not that the Americans have banned medicine. It's just that nobody with a boat will sail medicine to Iran. And no bank will handle the transaction. And so especially, you know, they can do aspirin and whatever, but when it comes to chemo drugs and stuff like that, they're at a severe disadvantage. And people are dying. The Human Cost of Iran Sanctions by Joy Gordon at Foreign Policy Today. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Sign up for the podcast feed there. You can get the whole show archives or the just the interviews, if you like just the interviews better there. ScottHorton.org. More than 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. I got a crazy CIA conspiracy theory for you here, which is that I think that Facebook will not show my posts to anyone. Out of my 5,000 Facebook friends, probably a good couple of dozen of them were friend requested by me. And so that's a couple of friends from high school, and I think Walter Block. Am I friends with Walter Block? He may have blocked me. I don't know. I can't say I've seen a post by him in a long time. Anyway, virtually 5,000 people have friended me on Facebook, and presumably they heard the show or like it or something. But then I post, hey, today on the show, a great journalist and a great academic about two of the most important things in the history of the whole world. How do you like that? And then I get no likes or shares. So then I say, you know what I need to do? I'll think smart with my noodle and I'll post a picture. And then Facebook will show everyone the picture that I posted. And then it'll say, oh yeah, by the way, there's a radio show today if you want to listen to it. And then somebody will like that, right? No. I think Facebook knows that I'm using it to try to communicate with people. And they don't take too kindly to that. I'm not certain why. Is it a math problem has screwed me here? What am I doing wrong? I've got to post it on somebody else's wall for anybody else to see it. I got to pay somebody to post it on my page from their account. Or maybe I should just give up on stupid freaking Facebook. Now, if I post a thing about, hey, look, a cop shoots a guy, people notice that. I mean, I guess they just notice that I've posted a link to ScottHorton.org before. And so then that's the problem, is I posted the same link too many times. Yeah, but what if that's what I want to do? I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, I know it's not the best show in the world, but at least I'm right about everything. I have Ron Paul on sometimes, you know? Some people like it. I think. Anyway. Man, I don't know. So, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show where I sit around complaining about things, including Facebook, apparently. But don't you worry, because in just a few minutes, I'm going to play this extremely important interview about the death toll from the Iraq War. And then after that, I'm going to be interviewing the great Barbara Slavin. I don't agree with her on everything, but she's really a good reporter. She's not really a columnist. She does columns from time to time. But really, she's a straight news reporter 90% of the time. And she does really well-informed coverage of the Iran issue, and I like it. I know sometimes people complain that she says something they don't agree with or whatever, but that's all right with me. She's going to be on. She's got the greatest scoop on earth, man. The Iranian nuclear deal. Look how great it is. Boy, I hope that I hadn't checked the Weekly Standard or whatever to see the Foreign Policy Initiative to see what Bill Kristol and the Legion of Doom have come up with to try to cast it as a sneaky end run around real confirmation of peaceful intent here, but it looks like they're willing to sign the additional protocol and a hell of a lot more to me. I'll take it. I never was worried in the first place. I don't care if Russia gives Iran 170 hydrogen bombs. How do you like that? But anyway, still, this is a good deal. I mean, I wouldn't encourage Russia to give them 50 hydrogen bombs, but I'm just saying. Sure as hell wouldn't support a war either way. So, I told you, man. Oh, you listen to me. I'm not mad at you. Snowden says he took no secret files to Russia. He didn't give anything to the Russians. He gave it to Glenn. So, when he left Hong Kong, he didn't have the stuff with him. Anymore, apparently. That's what he's told James Risen, the chief. I don't know what his title is. I would tell you he's the highest ranking national security beat reporter at the New York Times. And he does good work. He's the guy that, with Lichtblau, did the NSA story that the Times publishers kept secret for a year to make sure George W. Bush, that they didn't interfere with his reelection. And he's also the guy that documented how the Americans recruited a Russian to give the Iranians ready-made blueprints to nukes, to make a nuclear bomb, an implosion bomb, only with a couple of glaring errors. The Iranians, of course, were smart enough to throw it immediately in the trash because they sensed it was nothing but a frame-up job, Operation Merlin, Read all about that. He's in trouble for that right now, James Risen. The courts are saying he has to reveal his source, and he's saying no. And the courts are saying he has to. And he's now, in fact, just the other day, a federal appeals court said he has to. And now it's going to the Supreme Court, so he may go to jail for refusing to reveal who revealed that. But anyway, so I like James Risen. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, he works for the New York Times, but yeah, also he's a decent journalist. I ain't saying he's perfect or whatever. He's a decent journalist. Anyway, Snowden says he took no secret files to Russia. Edward J. Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor, said in an extensive interview this month that he did not take any secret NSA documents with him to Russia when he fled there in June, assuring them that Russian intelligence officials could not get, oh, assuring that Russian intelligence officials could not get access to them. And he says, so therefore it's just a absolute 100% verifiable fact that the Russians got nothing. And he is 100% certain that the Chinese also got nothing because he had access to everything about China's capability while he was at NSA. And he had access to everything about America's capability against China while he was at NSA. And so what that proves is he knew what to do to make sure that the Chinese government could not get their hands on his secrets. And it also proves that if he was just trying to destroy the American state's capability rather than bring these issues to light where the American people can use their democracy to pass laws in order to make reforms to choose to make their democratic society the way they want to be or whatever, he could have just given it all to the Chinese. He could have told the Chinese everything that the Americans have on the Chinese. And he said, you can tell that not only did I not give it to them, but that they weren't successful in taking it from me because all the accusations against me are these vague, ridiculous accusations about, well, he must have given them something or something. But if he actually had, the accusations would be something along the lines of the PLA is going dark. The Chinese government is making adjustments. They are shutting off the things that they now know America is spying on. But that hasn't happened. And we would know if that had happened. There would be leaks all over the place about Snowden the traitor. It hadn't happened. Because it's not true. And so, just think about the worms in the American media who have gone to such lengths to try to spread this smear that he just must have given the secrets to the Chinese and the Russians. In all probability, according to Commentary Magazine. Is that a thing? The Podhoretzes, are they still alive? Are people read that? In all probability, I keep harping on this one because it was the funniest one. It was the one where I literally LOL'd. That's the first time I've ever said that in my life. I'm sorry. The first time where I literally laughed out loud. The only reason I even said that is because I was not paying attention because I was realizing that I just blew through the break. Because I'm stupid. Anyway. The one where I actually laughed out loud. I swear I've never written LOL in my whole life, and that was the first time and second time I've ever even said that term in my life. I hate that. Why can't you just write heh like everybody else? Anyway, the one that I laughed at was the one in Time Magazine that said, well, you know what? I bet they gave him rupees. Roofies. Yeah, I bet they gave him the date rape drug. You know them Russians. They probably drugged him and probably stole all his files while he's at the airport and probably downloaded them all. And probably, you know what I bet they did when I used my pretend imagination? I imagine that what they might have done maybe was actually break all the codes and get all the secrets, I bet. They ran that in Time Magazine. Anyway, by definition, everyone who ever published a thing accusing Snowden of passing these secrets to the Russians and the Chinese, terrible people. Terrible people. I mean, I know I could leave it at, they have no evidence. for their false assertions smearing an American hero. But no, actually, no, they are terrible people. What kind of person would do such a thing? A terrible person would do such a thing. And that means you too, Bob Bear, and the rest of you. Smearing an American hero. Oh yeah? Put up or shut up then. Yeah, that's what I thought. Alright, so here's this great interview with Amy. Wait a minute. Before that, let me just tell you real quick what I was supposed to advertise for there a second ago would have been nothing. Don't worry about it. Huh. Is that even set right? I think I did that wrong. All right. Here, man. Listen to this. Introducing Amy Hagopian. She is Adjunct Associate Professor of Global Health at the University of Washington's Community-Oriented Public Health Practice Program. And, well, in fact, I guess I'll go ahead and let you introduce yourself more from there, because I know you have more credentials to speak of. And then also you're one of the authors of this mortality in Iraq study from the Public Library of Science, which is at plosmedicine.org. So welcome to the show, Amy. And I'm sorry, could you please give us the rest of your bio there?
Thank you, Scott. Yes, I'm a regular faculty member, not an adjunct, at the University of Washington.
Oh, sorry, that was old. I was reading there.
That's all right. And I teach classes in health policy, and I supervise graduate student research, and I conduct my own research. Mostly, my area in global health is on the issue of health worker migration from poor countries to rich countries.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that ties right into Iraq. That's got to be the biggest story of doctors fleeing from one country to another in this century so far anyway, right?
Oh, doctors flee Africa as well, because fleeing poverty is as common as fleeing war. So, yeah, none of it's very reflective of a world in a good situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this article is the first study in a long time that anybody has done since Opinion Business Research back in 2008 on the excess death rate in Iraq. And I think back when the Lancet and Johns Hopkins studies came out, that was one of the emigration of doctors was one of the things that was being brought up as one of the reasons why the excess death rate had risen. It wasn't just the violence from the war, and it wasn't just people getting cholera from dirty water or unable to get to the hospital because of the checkpoints and the war situation going on, all of those things. But also, the doctors, you know, they're the kinds of people who can afford a plane ticket. They were in Jordan. They got the hell out of there. And so, and especially the very best of them. So that was one of the, I don't know how major of a factor it was, whatever, but apparently that's been a factor in the excess death rate in Iraq since 2003.
Well, we actually don't know the direct line between doctor migration and death rates. And this points to an interesting area that I think is worth talking about, which is that there are no science funding agencies, either the U.S. government or any other government or even in the private sector, that fund this sort of research. The 12 authors on our study, who I led across four universities, were all volunteers. We donated our time to this work because we thought it was important. Mm-hmm. But the National Institutes of Health does not invest in researching the effects of war on the public's health, for a variety of reasons, no doubt. And it's time that they did, because we need much better science and much better capacity to measure this major public health problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so there's lies and damn lies and statistics, and you guys got a pile of statistics here. How can you assure us that they mean what you think they mean? How can you assure yourselves?
Well, let me tell you our approach. This is a public health science approach to trying to estimate mortality. There are other approaches out there, and I can talk about those if you want. But our approach was to randomly select 100 neighborhoods across the nation of Iraq. We did that in a way that was population weighted, so we were likely to get a sample that was distributed the way the population is distributed. And then within each neighborhood, we randomly selected a start household, and that was kind of an interesting method we used using Google Earth Maps, and we would drop a small meshed grid over the neighborhood that we had chosen and randomly selected a start house by just choosing a rooftop. And then on the ground, we would go find that house. So we would survey 20 households in each of those 100 neighborhoods for a total of 2,000 households. And in each place, we asked the head of household to tell us who lives here, who lived here in 2001 before the war started, and who has been born and who has died, and if they died, what did they die of? And through this method, we can calculate death rates for each year. And we compared the pre-war death rate with the post-war death rate and multiplied those rates times the full population to arrive at estimates of total mortality. We saw a significant increase in the mortality rate before the war and after. Interestingly, our estimate was that probably about 500,000 people died in this war. You asked how confident we are in that number, and I would say we're actually fairly confident that that number is low. And the reason we think it's low is because many of the families who experienced mortality in Iraq did just as you said, they left.
Right.
And when they left no one behind to tell us about the mortality experience in their household.
Right. Well, and there were approximately 4.5 million refugees, and I guess about half of those internally displaced, Sunnis purged from mostly Baghdad and other now Shiite-dominated regions, and then Shiites purged from the Anbar province in response and back and forth like that. In fact, that might have been first.
Well, we used very conservative estimates of migration to try to adjust our number. We used the 2 million out-migration figure that the UN supplied. But, you know, again, those are people who tend to register as migrants, which lots of people don't. And we had a small study out of Syria that suggested 15% of those households had experienced death. And so we made a very modest adjustment in our calculations to try to account for the migration. But we think it's low and it's conservative.
Right. Well, and that's the best way to approach something like this, obviously, anyway. To go back, it was in 2004 and then again in 2006 when Lancet and Johns Hopkins did their studies, and they had almost 700,000 by 2006. And then I noticed, I wasn't able to read the whole thing, but I didn't notice any reference to Opinion Business Research in their study that concluded that as many as 1 million had died in 2007 and 2008. And they even did the study twice to try to make sure that, wow, because that sure is a pretty high number. How conservative do you think is your estimate? And I wonder why no mention of OBR there.
We did actually mention OBR. We have a paragraph in the discussion section where we talk about how our results compare to others. Opinion Business Research is a business firm that used its polling capacity to try to estimate mortality, and that was fascinating, and that's the high water mark. The other two Lancet studies that were done involved some of the same people who were involved in this study. We were doing our study in the middle of 2011. A long time had passed since 2001, just before the war. So we were asking people to remember a very long period of time, and people tend to forget things. And so we're pretty sure our estimate is low. The other sort of brand of research out there trying to estimate mortality is the Iraq body count.
Mm-hmm.
And those people clip newspaper articles and try to count up the dead from reports in the press and other places. We know that those reports are low. They recently tried to adjust their reports based on the WikiLeaks data that had been released, which was sort of an interesting exercise. Still, it's very low. And they are estimating around 125,000. Of course, those deaths don't include the indirect deaths, the people who died who didn't need to die, but didn't die of being shot or blown up, right. Rather died of a heart attack or some other indirect cause of the war.
Right. Yeah, and just the deprivation from living in a wartime society for 8 years. And it's so easy to imagine, right? The heart attack is the perfect example, a situation where even under the sanctions regime, he could have made it to the hospital and been fine. But in this case, he got stuck behind a checkpoint and didn't make it, that kind of thing.
That's correct.
And then, but multiplied over thousands and thousands of times. Same thing for the cholera in the water, right?
That's right. War wreaks havoc on a society in many, many countless ways. I think it wreaks havoc on the invader as well as the invaded. Certainly, it redirects resources from what might have been something that produces health, like education, and directs it towards something that destroys health.
Yeah. Now, talk about the significance of asking them about their siblings. You did this in a way to try to weight their other responses.
Well, it wasn't a weighting so much. We asked about siblings because as long as we were in the household, we wanted to try a new method. And this is a method that's used in many low-income countries to try to estimate infant mortality rates, those sorts of things in countries where they don't have a census. So this hasn't been done in a war setting before, and we were experimenting with it. Again, like I said, the science in this is just so undeveloped. But when you knock on a door in Iraq, there's a lot of people who live there. Household size is around six. So what we did was asked every adult in the household to tell us about their siblings. So we were able to learn about 25,000 additional people by way of doing this. And we were able to calculate the risk of mortality for adults. Again, it's just one segment of the population. It's adults, which are about a third of the deaths in the population are attributable to the 15 to 60 age group. And these 25,000 people told us about their siblings, if they were alive or dead, if they were dead, what they died of, and we were able to see then the proportion of deaths that were attributable to violence, which in the case of adults was about 70%, the excess deaths.
Now, that was actually surprising to me. I mean, as violent and horrible as that war was, I guess I just imagined that the deprivation of, you know, basic necessities and just a lack of distribution and sanity, sanitization, that kind of thing. You know what I mean? Sanity,
uh-huh.
That's different. That's my problem. Not
right.
sanitization, all that. I thought that the excess death rate, it would mostly be that, right? All the kind of unintended consequences all over the place. But no, it was really the violence of the American and Iraqi armies and the militias, the various militias and Sunni insurgents. And I think you say even the super majority of those are by bullets, not bombings, right?
Yes. So of excess deaths, the majority are due to violence. And of the violence, it's mostly shooting.
And then, now, that counts crime too, right? Because obviously kidnapping became an epidemic there.
You know, in wars like this, it's very hard to figure out who is who and what their motivations are.
Right.
And, you know, whose side are they on? One of the questions I get asked by the media is, well, were you counting combatants in your totals? And the answer is yes, because combatants live in households and households are who is doing the reporting. And we didn't ask that question for a variety of good reasons. Was this person a combatant or not? Because if somebody is a baker all day long, and in the evening a couple nights a week they go make incendiary devices, is that person a baker or a bomb maker? I don't know, and I wouldn't want to be in the position to try to categorize that person, and we don't know whose side they're on or what interests they're representing, and it's complicated.
Yeah. Well, you didn't count the Iraqi army casualties from the first 3 weeks of the war and the actual invasion, though, right?
We counted whoever lived in those households.
Well, and I guess that would have been a very small proportion of the numbers anyway.
Oh, yes. Certainly, yes.
The vast majority of the violence took place after the Americans fired the army and turned them all into civilians.
So. Well, the conduct of the war was its own sad story, and we didn't...
Well, I'm just saying that made civilians out of... The vast numbers of privates in Saddam's army became bakers again, or whatever they should have been doing with their life anyway at that point.
Yes.
Well, now, okay, so how many neighborhoods did you go to in Kurdistan? And I wonder whether, you know, it seems like if you go to the average Kurd household and ask them, relatively speaking, they've done a lot better than... not just Arabs in the rest of Iraq, but certainly better than Arabs in Kurdistan, who there was a much less covered, but still a constant kind of ongoing, silent war, but sort of low-level war of ethnic cleansing of the Arabs out of Kurdistan. So I wonder, you know, do you take that into account when you go into a neighborhood of which kind of people you're talking to here, to put it bluntly and rudely?
We weighted the population by size and randomly chose by size. So the larger the geographic area, the larger a chance it had of being chosen. And we did go to every governorate in Iraq, and there's a table in the paper. You know, by the way, for your listeners, this paper is completely freely available on the internet at PLOS Medicine. And you can see the table of each governorate and how many people we interviewed in that place and how that compares to the most recently available census, which it was actually conducted a long time ago, regrettably.
Well, you know, I have to say, it seems like the media reaction to this study is, wow, would you look at that, rather than the vicious denunciations and denials that came with the Lancet studies, for example. I guess the OBR report was mostly greeted with silence, but...
Yes, it is interesting that I think people's... the response has not been hostile from... politicians have sort of not said anything, which is kind of interesting. The people who critique this sort of science haven't said much either. We made our data completely available on the internet for people to analyze. The response is always interesting. You know, public opinion polling shows that Americans and British people believe that only about 10,000 people died in the war. And, of course, that's woefully low in relation to what's actually the case, and probably reflects the great efforts that the U.S. and British government went to try to keep people from knowing how many people died.
Right. Yeah, I wonder... I wonder how well this is going to get through. You know, it's not like they're giving it that much attention, but, I don't know. Did it make the cover of USA Today or anything? Where, you know, the average American might see it on the bus ride to work?
Yeah, not so much, no.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, I mean, that really is, that alone is almost as bad as the casualties, the denial that the American and British people get to indulge in about the consequences of sort of their actions, their government's actions that they're somewhat responsible for anyway. You know, that's not right.
Well, interestingly, when you, you know, I'm old enough that I was a kid during the Vietnam War, a teenager, and the way progress in that war was measured was by the body count. And we'd hear about the body count on our TV every night, and we would see film footage from Vietnam of our soldiers killing people. And, you know, it didn't take too long to turn the tide against that war, to be seeing it on our television and to be hearing the body counts. And I think the war wagers have learned this, that people really don't have much appetite for body count. And, you know, I think it's to the public's credit that the people who waged this war felt they really couldn't report high body counts and sustain public support for it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing. The argument was, okay, yeah, there's some problems, but it's going to be worth it at some point. We can't leave now because then it will get worse. Now is better than if we left for them. That was the argument the whole time. So they couldn't be honest about how many people they were getting killed.
On the other hand, you look at Iraq today, and it is worse than it was a year ago. And, you know, that's not because we were protecting people particularly, but, you know, we launched a war that left that country in shambles and in chaos and people fighting amongst themselves. And it's just a tragedy.
Sure. Well, it's certainly not worse than it was in 2006, 7, and 8.
No.
Well, I don't know, 8 so much, but 5, 6, 7, those were the worst years of it. But anyway, so listen, I've already kept you over the time. I promised you I'd keep you at 20 minutes. So thanks very much. I really appreciate your work on this, and I appreciate your time on the show, Amy.
Thank you so much, Scott.
All right, everybody. That is Amy Hagopian. The study is at plosmedicine.org. That's the Public Library of Science. plosmedicine.org. You can read the whole study there. Mortality in Iraq associated with the 2003 through 2011 war and occupation. And you can read all about it at america.aljazeera.com and antiwar.com and a few other places as well.
All right. Well, there you go.
I'm really not very good at interviewing people. I mean, I do it often. And I'm interested in what's important. I'm not a very good interviewer. So one drawback to having help, the great Adam McDonald helps me with the editing and the posting of the show, so I don't have to go back and listen to myself. But maybe I should have to go back and listen to myself sometimes. Actually, Scott Horton, you kind of suck. I wonder nobody likes you on Facebook, man. All right. Hey, listen, did you see the pictures of the cop killing this guy in Dallas? Oh, no, they didn't kill him. They shot him 4 times. Oh, no, shot at him. Well, let's see. I think they hit him 4 times, and nobody knows how many shots were fired. Some of them went stray through neighbors' windows, who luckily weren't home at the time. Anyway. Little Fallujah, they call it. Dallas, Texas. Yeah. And so the cops... man, and this is the saddest part of it, of course, is... Well, at least the kid's still alive. Well, young guy, whoever, is still alive. But it was the mother that called the cops. Because the mother, instead of going by the local news, she's still going by Law and Order episodes. She's still going by all the dramas on TV that say that the cops care about you. And they're here to take good care of you. And they're here to, you know, give your loved one who's a little bit out of line a stern talking to. They're going to come and they're going to... negotiate. They're going to de-escalate and they're going to separate everybody and they're going to hear everybody's side of the story and then they're going to make everyone come to a calm understanding and mutual agreement. No, they're not. They're going to kill somebody if they have a chance. And what happened in this case, and you have to listen very closely to hear the cops thinking, but if you listen very closely, you can hear them thinking, ooh, he's got a knife in his hand. Now's my chance to take another human life. Finally, I'm going to be able to kill somebody.
I'm certain I'll get away with this one. Bang, 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 and then they shoot the guy. He's just standing there. Even the local news people are like, man, his hands and feet don't move at all. Look at his feet. They don't move. The cops say in their report he was lunging at them with a knife. Well, that is simply a bald-faced lie by the laws of science. Did not happen. And in fact, the cop seems to bend down and pick something up right around the place the guy was standing when they first pulled up, which I assume was the knife itself. That the guy had already dropped the knife. He's in an office chair on wheels, you know? He's in the middle of a cul-de-sac. The cops pull up, get out of the car. He backs up. I think that was where he dropped the knife, because that's where the cop bends down later. And anyway, they almost killed him. And I just wonder whether anybody's ever going to get tired of this, you know? I mean, anybody with power. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. Full interview archives are at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 now, going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube @ScottHortonShow. Next up is Barbara Slavin. She writes for Al Monitor and other places as well, or at least used to, I don't know. Here she is. She's got the scoop of the week, at least. Iran's new nuclear proposal. Welcome back to the show, Barbara. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. And let me just say, I have a piece of Iran's nuclear proposal. I don't have the PowerPoint that was presented in Geneva. I have something that an Iranian source who has usually proved reliable says is the essence of Iran's proposal. So I want to caveat that. I have not seen the actual PowerPoint presentation.
But it is a piece of paper, at least, not just hearsay.
It's not a piece of paper. It's information that I was given from an Iranian source who has usually proved reliable.
Okay.
Okay, so listeners should have that caveat. That said, some of it has also been reported by Michael Adler, and the substance of the proposal sounds quite reasonable to me.
Yeah, well, it's really something. I was going to say, if it's a piece of disinformation, at least they did hard work on putting it together.
They did.
It sounded legit to me.
It was written in such a way that it sounded completely like a logical proposal. So,
right.
You know, this is source I've known a long time, usually proven reliable. And you know, it's caused a great consternation, apparently, in Iran and in various other circles. And I see I'm being denounced on Facebook, this time as a Saudi tool, which is interesting. But I'm very happy to discuss what I've learned and also just to discuss the negotiations in general.
Right. Okay, great. Well, the good thing is the audience of this show is pretty familiar with, you know, what's at issue. In other words, you know, you can talk about the Fordow facility and 20% enriched uranium without having to get all the way down into, you know, explaining it from 101 on, which is nice. So, please do go ahead and give us the overview of what we're looking at here.
All right, well, this is what I was told, and I'm going to actually call up my my story on Al Monitor so I can basically read that back to folks, if you want to just give me a second here and make sure that I have it exactly as written.
No problem. Again, it's called Iran's New Nuclear Proposal at AlMonitor.com.
Right. Right, it's on AlMonitor.com. The proposal let's start with the overall background, and this I know from extremely good Iranian sources, that Iran wants to see the end game before they even begin down this road. So the idea is to have a two-stage proposal, 6 months in each stage. Iran knows what the end game is going to be, and then it begins down the road of confidence-building measures in return for concessions from the United States and its negotiating partners. So in the first stage, the Iranians have said that they would stop producing uranium enriched to 20% U-235, and they would convert the stockpile that they have entirely into fuel for the Tehran Research Reactor, which produces medical isotopes. Now, the way my source put it was that they would try to convert their stockpile. I understand that the Iranians, while they have converted some of this enriched uranium into a powder form, they don't really know how to make the fuel rods for the Tehran Research Reactor, so they might need some assistance. But this is a very important concession, to stop producing uranium that's enriched to 20%. That's very close, very easy to continue to enrich that to weapons grade. They also say that they will not stop work on another project. This is the heavy water reactor at Arak. That's A-R-A-K, not I-R-A-Q. But that they would let the IAEA come and monitor the completion of the facility, and that when it's done, they would reach an arrangement to handle the spent fuel, which is similar to the arrangement they currently have for their only functioning civilian nuclear power reactor, which is at Bushehr. The Russians provide the fuel and take back the spent fuel. This is important because the Arak heavy water reactor could yield plutonium, which is another potential bomb fuel. Now, of course, Iran does not have a reprocessing facility to turn that into bomb fuel, but this would be an extra confidence-building measure to turn over the spent fuel from this. They also promise more monitoring, full monitoring of the underground enrichment plant at Fordow, which would be turned into a research center, and to limit the scale of production at their Natanz enrichment plant. And they promised to ratify the additional protocol of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which now allows unannounced inspections of nuclear sites. So taken together, I mean, it's a fairly coherent proposal. And they're not asking for the moon in return. They understand that the U.S. Congress is not going to give them sanctions relief, certainly not at the beginning. And so they're looking for things that are within the purview of the executive branch that the White House can do on its own to ease the impact of sanctions on the Iranian people. Now, this proposal, if it is accurate, and I can't swear 100%, as I said, it was given to me by somebody who's proven reliable in the past, this proposal would be an opening negotiating bid, and obviously subject to negotiations with the P5+1, and there are elements of it, frankly, that I think would be unacceptable to the United States and its negotiating partners. So we'll have to see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can certainly see why all of the Western negotiators from the Security Council were very optimistic coming out of the meeting earlier this week, and were talking about, hey, this is, you know, perhaps really the basis of something that they could work with. And of course, there's been all kinds of other reporting, which we don't have to go back over, about the lack of bluster on both sides and how important that was that they actually were really willing to talk about. But this really does sound like almost a dream come true. Not quite what the Americans were asking for, but
no, I wouldn't go that far. I really wouldn't go that far. As I say, there, you know, the
well, I mean, they want a closing down of Fordow, and these guys want to convert it into a research facility. So that's pretty good, right?
Yeah, but look, you know, as long as they're enriching uranium, there are going to be people who think that the Iranians want to build a bomb, and that this is all a big hoax, and they're just trying to fool the West and so on. And then there are going to be people in Iran who say these are too many concessions. Iran should not convert its 20% uranium and should not allow this kind of intrusive monitoring. So this proposal is one that would not satisfy, frankly, the hardliners on either side, and according to what U.S. diplomats have said, will require a great deal more work. You know, I should point out that the Russians actually poo-pooed all this. The Russian deputy foreign minister who was at the Geneva talks said there was nothing to applaud about here. So, this is still early days. A lot more is going to happen. The Wendy Sherman, the head of our delegation, has to brief Congress on what was achieved. I'm sure we're going to see more leaks from the U.S. side going forward, as well as from the Iranian side. And, perhaps in the end we will finally see the full proposal, or maybe we won't, because it will have been changed by the time any kind of agreement is reached.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just seems to me like, I mean, obviously, the hawks are never going to be satisfied on either side, not with any deal that is possible to be reached by the middle. But so the goal is to see if you can come up with an agreement that will be enough where the middle, in this case, Obama and Rouhani, will be able to tell their hawks, yeah, but look what we got out of it. That's pretty good. You know, they have to have a good enough argument to win. But it seems like this. That's what I meant by dream come true, is that, they really have, I think, based on that outline, again, unverified, but this outline of this proposed deal, seems like they've neutralized all of the biggest points, like the 20% enrichment, plutonium that'll be left over from Iraq.
There are still people who don't want Iran. It doesn't say anything about the 5% and under enriched uranium. And they have a very large stockpile of that. They have, in fact, a huge amount of that. And there are many people who don't want them to continue to have that stockpile and to continue to enrich uranium. They have something like over 20,000 pounds of low-enriched uranium. So, it's a reasonable proposal from my point of view. It's a reasonable start. And in the story, I quote Daryl Kimball, who's executive director of the Arms Control Association. He called it a genuine, serious response to the P5+1 proposal, the last one that they made. But others will disagree. I mean, Rob Satloff of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy put on his Twitter feed, that this was basically useless, but the only good thing about it was that it was in English. it didn't have to be translated. I think there's going to be a lot of negotiating that's going to have to happen.
Yeah, well, just don't hire Winnip to do the negotiating, and I think it might work.
No, they've got their point of view. Everybody has a point of view. Everybody has an axe to grind. Me, I'm just a journalist. I'm trying to report what I hear and trying to be accurate and trying to be constructive.
Sure, no, I understand. And you do great work, too. I mean, this is a hell of a story that you've got here. And you had another good one the other day that was, it seemed to be an opinion piece, the one where you were talking about how this is not Munich and that kind of thing. But it was almost 99% just factual reporting and news analysis as it is anyway, so...
thank you very much.
I certainly appreciate that about you.
That's a real bugaboo, that people use these analogies. Iran is Iran. It's not Nazi Germany. It's not Mao's China. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not North Korea. Iran is Iran. Why is that so hard for people to figure out? This idea that somehow merely negotiating with the Iranians is like dealing with Nazi Germany in 1938, give me a break. Who's the Adolf Hitler here, and what countries is Iran invading? Iran is actually more isolated than it's been in decades, and certainly hurting under economic sanctions. It doesn't have a particularly powerful conventional military, it's just a ridiculous parallel that tries to, raise the idea that Iran is out to exterminate Jews and take over the world, and this is a paranoid fantasy.
Clearly, yeah. All right, well, now, so as far as American politics, obviously there's a lot to it, and you've already alluded to the fact that a lot of these sanctions would have to be lifted by Congress, that the president doesn't even have the authority to the leeway to make some of those decisions himself, which I'm very glad to hear that the Iranians are accepting that fact up front and are being cool about it and are are, you know, limited in their demands for what they're asking for in return there. But I wonder if you think that as far as their side of the negotiations, you mentioned there's no mention of Natanz here. Obviously, something's going to have to be worked out about the 3.5% in
risk. There is a mention that they would reduce, you know, the production, the scale of production there. But,
but I
haven't seen any specifics. And I don't know that they actually have given any specifics. And they haven't said anything, at least in what I was shown, about the stockpile, as I mentioned, of,
right,
of low-enriched uranium.
I'm sorry. And that was what I meant to refer to there, was what they've already enriched to 3.6% or thereabouts. Anyway, so my question, though, was going to be, do you think that it's really even possible, if Obama is really trying to do this, do you think it's even possible, or do you think that even he or his team would recognize or, you know, accept enrichment to 3.6% at Natanz, even under, you know, assuming the additional protocol and the rest of these things? Or are they still going to stick with the UN resolutions that they pushed back in the Bush era that say you must freeze all enrichment?
You know, I think it depends on what the whole package is. If the stockpiles of 20% are removed, if the Iranians stop producing to that level, if the IAEA is given even more access than they already have, and they already have a fair amount of access, by the way, they're inspectors in Iran every day of the year now, and they go to these facilities at least once a week. But if they allow, you know, remote monitoring with cameras 24 hours a day, various kinds of things like that, it's possible. It's possible, but Iran is also going to have to satisfy the international community in terms of the past history of the program. There are certainly a lot of reports that Iran had a nuclear weapons research program at one point, and they've never entirely satisfied people's questions about that. So, as I say, this is early days, and you know, we're going to have to see a lot more.
By the way, have you talked with any experts who can clarify how long that stockpile of 3.6% enriched uranium that they already have might last if it was fueling Bushehr, for example?
Well, you know, that's the irony of this. Iran gets the fuel for Bushehr from the Russians. Iran has no other civilian power reactors, which is why people say, why are they enriching uranium? What do they need it for? And Iran, frankly, would do much better with wind and solar rather than nuclear reactors, given the fact that this is a country that's prone to earthquakes. Dare I say the word Fukushima? So, you know, I think the Iranians have this program for a lot of reasons that have very little to do with generating electricity. I think it's deterrence and national pride and inertia, because they have all these nuclear scientists who've been working on this stuff so long. You know, and it's, they want to trade it for something. It's a bargaining chip. They want to get something for all that they put into it. But in terms of actually generating, you know, electricity, I really don't think that's the main reason.
Yeah, you know, Ali Gharib thought that, he said on the show a couple of weeks back that he thought that really the main reason they've pursued it all along was just so they could negotiate it away to be brought back in from the cold. I guess I had thought that they would never abandon enrichment entirely, just as for national pride reasons that you just mentioned, but he thought, nah, they might do that, you know?
That's a tough one. I think they would want to keep some elements of the program, as we see from this proposal. They would want to keep as much of it as possible. They certainly want to keep their research reactor, the Tehran research reactor, or a replacement, because they want to be able to in their own country. The question is, do they have to enrich fuel for it? Do they have to make the fuel rods for it? And there, you know, they'll say, well, they want to be self-sufficient. They can't trust the rest of the world. It's kind of a vicious cycle. You know, the world doesn't trust Iran. Therefore, they feel they have to make this stuff on their own. Well, if they had a better relationship with the rest of the world, maybe, you know, they wouldn't have to worry so much.
Right. Yeah, it is a chicken and the egg kind of thing, where even going back to the 90s, where Clinton had stopped the Russians and the Chinese from providing some nuclear facilities and turnkey equipment and whatever. So they went ahead and got it from AQ Khan and the black market from Pakistan, that kind of stuff,
right.
Made their own.
Right.
But, yeah. So, anyway, well, I sure do appreciate this journalism that you do here. I read you all the time. I follow you on Twitter. And we were all wondering exactly what's in there. And I guess we don't really know, but we got a much better idea of what's being proposed here, thanks to you. So thank you, Barbara, very much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right. All right. That is Barbara Slavin at Al Monitor. That's almonitor.com. Iran's new nuclear proposal. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Rocky Mountain Miners at RockyMountainMiners.com. Ever wanted to destroy the Federal Reserve System? Now's your chance. New free market currencies are making our fake government money a thing of the past, and good riddance. If you want to mine new bitcoins and litecoins into circulation, you need a computer set up to crack the codes to the new coins. Get the prospector from RockyMountainMiners.com. It's ready to do the work right out of the box. Crack the equations, spend the money. Use promo code Scott Horton Show and save $100. Get all the info and get the prospector at RockyMountainMiners.com.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. Hey, it's fundraising time over there at KPFK again. Or so I'm told. So, no me, oh my, this Sunday on KPFK. I am preempted. Now, if I was KPFK, I would host me as the guest on Sunday morning and say, this is why you ought to donate for this great show. Maybe I'm not good for fundraising. Maybe they focus grouped it and decided not. I think it's just a technical pain, so forget it. Anyway, I'm Scott Horton, so that was Barbara Slavin. So there you go, that's pretty good. A freeze on 20% enrichment. Convert the stock of the 20% to fuel rods for the medical isotope reactor. They might need some help from somebody getting it done, but there you go. And then export all the spent fuel, which would include plutonium. Not that they have the ability to separate out the plutonium, but that's not going to stop Benjamin Netanyahu from crying, right? So anyway, here they'll export it out of the country. That ought to shut them up about that, right? And then full monitoring of Fordo as it is converted into a research facility. No more 20%. So what are you going to do with Fordo? Well, I don't know. Science experiments. And then slow down and limit Natanz. She said they didn't specify what they would do with the stockpile of 3.6% rich uranium they already have. But that they would more or less slow down and limit the amount of uranium enriched at the Natanz facility. Which, of course, by the way, they didn't even open that thing for business till 2006, really. Beginning of 06, end of 05, I think. Because they were voluntarily abiding by the additional protocol and had voluntarily frozen any starting of enrichment. They hadn't even begun. They took the BBC on a tour, and it was just like a Walmart underground, a giant underground Walmart full of nothing. Just a big warehouse. Under 75 feet of granite, but a warehouse. And they didn't even start putting in the centrifuges till after that. So that was their big, secret facility that they got because Bill Clinton wouldn't let the Chinese sell them a light water reactor. I think it was supposed to be a light water reactor. Which, a light water reactor, it's good because it's good for non-proliferation because it produces plutonium, but it's completely and totally polluted with a bunch of other crap, so it makes it very difficult to separate out and get any kind of usable. I mean, very difficult. Well, apparently. I don't know. I never tried myself. I'm just saying. Apparently, it makes it basically not worth your while to even give it a shot, separating out any plutonium. Some say I think it's impossible. I don't know. Whereas a heavy water reactor like they're going to have at Iraq, which would just run on natural, not enriched uranium, that produces weapons-grade plutonium, which it does have to be harvested and separated out somewhat, but not in the same, not to the same degree, I guess. And here's another thing you ought to know about that anyway. Even if they didn't have, even if they don't make this deal and they end up opening the Iraq reactor and it ends up producing weapons-grade plutonium, they can't get it out of there without taking the lid off and making it, you know, shutting it down and letting it cool for an extended period of time and then taking the lid off and harvesting it out of there. And in other words, absolutely impossible to do in secret. Absolutely impossible to do in secret. And they already have, I think she mentioned this, they already have a deal with the Russians where the Russians come and harvest all the stuff out of Bushehr and they take it themselves out of the country. And that would be what they would do with Iraq's, Iraq, that's A-R-A-K, with the weapons-grade waste from there. And then, or potentially, you know, weapons-grade waste. And then, let's see, slow down in tons. Additional protocol which allow for more inspections. I meant to clarify and follow up on that one, whether she meant, or whether they said non-nuclear facilities. I believe she does say in the article non-nuclear facilities. So that would mean where they make the centrifuges. That would mean missile plants even. I don't know, man. They're not going to let them do that. Maybe. And all they're asking for is that they lift the sanctions that Obama can lift, the ones that are preventing medicine from being sold by companies in other countries. God, what kind of monsters are the Americans? Give in to our 10,000 demands and we'll let you have your hemophilia medicine again. We'll let you have your chemotherapy. Oh, you're already at stage 4, huh? Too bad. So sad. Anyway, so there you go. I don't know. You can't get people as excited about making a peace deal as you can get them about supporting a war or stopping a war, I guess. But if they made this deal, that would make war with Iran virtually impossible. I mean, they weren't able to use Iran's help for America in Iraq as an excuse to attack them back in 2007. They haven't been able to use the nuclear issue as an excuse to attack them this whole time. And if they take this away, that's it. And we don't have an alliance with Saudi Arabia. If Saudi Arabia and Iran get into a war, we just back both sides like Ronald Reagan, probably. Lord knows they play both sides of all our wars. But if they make this nuclear deal, then no war for the neocons. And that's why the Washington Institute for Near East Policy is tweeting that, oh, there's nothing good here at all except that it's in English. That's because the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, she's actually wrong when she reports that they have a point of view. They don't. They represent a point of view of someone else, Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party in Israel. Hey, I didn't hear no bumper music, did you? I'm going to turn this thing up.
Hi, I'm Brad Newman. I'm the creator of MyHeroesThink.com. Are you a fan of Ron Paul, Harry Brown, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises? Me too. These guys are my intellectual heroes, and because I can, I've decided to create my own monuments to them. So I'm bringing back the headbust. Visit MyHeroesThink.com and check out my artwork. Maybe you still have 5 empty inches on your bookshelf, or some space next to your computer. Maybe you'd enjoy having a statue of the libertarian who inspired you to think. Maybe you know a young person who just found these ideas and you'd like to inspire them with a gift. I really can't think of people with more integrity to look up to. Visit MyHeroesThink.com and sign up for the mailing list. Be the first to know when my Hayek and Hazlitt statues become available. Most importantly, be sure to type Scott Horton into the promo line so we can help support this show, because I'm sick of bombing people. Visit MyHeroesThink.com.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm fitting to tweet out the phone number here. ScottHorton.org/listen. Phone number's no good if they ain't listening, you know? And, yeah, man, I'll be happy to take y'all's calls if you want. Posting on Facebook, too, there. I got plenty of news to cover, but if you guys want to call in, the phone number is 512-271-4836. That's 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. 877-513-0792. It's rare that we have such good news to talk about in foreign policy as the progress on these Iran nuclear talks. I don't know. I don't think I was all Pollyanna about this back in 2009, was I? I don't think so. I think this time I'm looking at it like, you know, I think maybe that the Democrats actually want to make a deal here. And listen, in case you're not all that familiar with this subject and whatever, let me just tell you real honest here, in case you don't already know. The Iranians ain't making nuclear bombs, and even if a devil came down from heaven and gave them one, they are not going to throw it right at Israel anyway. This whole thing is stupid. The whole thing is stupid. But I think that Obama can just neutralize it if he wants to. And I think he does want to. I guess the question is, how hard is he going to try? He's going to have to try. There are, as Barbara Slavin explained, there are war hawks who would, and on both sides too, who would see him fail if they could. And, you know, I don't know. It'd be nice to say the wind is at our backs, you know, the anti-war movement, because such a great job was done by the American people. Never mind the anti-war movement. The American people just said hell no to a war in Syria last month. Remember that? The Republicans and Democrats were talking about, yeah, let's bomb things. And TV was saying, what can be done to convince the American people that we gotta do this? And then the American people said, no. That was really something else, man. I hope the history books don't just skip right over that or something, because that was a big deal to me. That was a big deal objectively and scientifically in, you know, space-time and stuff. That was a thing, man. Now, I don't know what it takes to harness that same spirit and say, yay, Obama! Peace talks are great! We love it when you make nuclear deals with people. And we don't mean the give them more like India deals. We mean the, we are not going to bomb you because you finally convinced us you're not making nuclear bombs type of deals. Make one of those. We love those deals. Make a deal like that, Obama, cry the people. Right? Call your congressman, seriously, and say, you know what? I don't like this Obama guy, but I like this. Call your Republicans and tell them, I hate that Obamacare. I hate everything about the Democrats, but I like this. This is a solution to our problem. Don't you block him. And even better, get out ahead of Obama in this parade and start denouncing Obama for taking too damn long to make this deal. Huh? See, it's like I'm a political genius. Hey, Republicans, you know how to get more votes and therefore more money for later?
more money. Get out in front of Obama on this peace with Iran parade. That's what I say. Who are you going to listen to? Bill Kristol, who's been wrong about everything he said for, well, 20-something years running now. Everything he was wrong about. Up to and including this week. And this is a guy, Bill Kristol, who talks more than me. And he's been wrong about everything. Seems to me like you ought to just do the opposite of what he wants. So there you go. I don't know. Everybody in the country knew. Because people were saying to their brothers, their sisters, their cousins, their people, man, did you hear about they're going to try to get us into war in Syria now? Right? People who don't know anything about the news, even. People don't know, never mind about foreign policy. They just are living their lives in their little worlds and or their big worlds, but in different directions that don't know about this stuff. Everybody was talking about, man, did you hear they're trying to get us into a war with a country called Syria, apparently, now? And people's reaction to that was, no, we've had enough of that. But so what does it take to get people aware that there's a real chance for a nuclear deal with the Iranians here? You know, I'm afraid that if it fails, then they'll say, see, you just can't deal with them Iranians. Now we gotta bomb them. That's the danger of something like this, is that it'll just serve not just as a checkbox on the road to war. Yeah, we tried to deal with them and it didn't work, but one that's really filled in with a big black magic marker. Man, you saw it. We really tried. You know what I mean? If it's a credible go at it and then they still fail, then that makes a great talking point for war later, unfortunately. But anyway, the 20% is such a big talking point for the war party. Take it away from them. They're willing to freeze 20% enrichment. That's uranium-235, 20% pure uranium-235, the rest 238 and other junk isotopes or whatever. But anyway, 235, that's the sweet stuff. For blowing stuff up or making electricity with or whatever. So they're willing to put all of it to other uses and stop making any more of it. Make the deal. Number one war party talking point in America is that 20% enriched uranium. So, you know, I don't know. I don't, whatever power and influence I've got is only within your ears, you know, between your ears. That's it. So do what I say. Call Capitol Hill and tell them you like this. You're tired of this conflict. And especially call your Republicans and be right wing about it. Don't say, hey, I stink like patchouli and I agree with Michael Moore about this peace deal. Call up and tell him that you prayed about it and you think that Jesus wants Obama to be able to make this deal. Call up and tell him that you're a fiscal conservative and we just can't afford this kind of crisis over there anymore. Call up and tell him you're an anti-communist and you were once mistaken but learned that Nixon did the right thing by making a friend out of China. And separating China from the Soviet Union and separating China from our failure in Vietnam. What a perfect way to make it okay that we lost the Iraq war and handed Iraq to the Iranians. We'll just make friends with the Iranians. Never mind regime change, we'll just make friends with the ones that we got now. Anyway. Whenever you're dealing with a liberal or a conservative, I don't know, you know, I don't deal with congressional people. If you can stand to call Congress to do anything as far as actual electoral politics and interacting with these folks, you always want to try to out-argue the liberals on the left and out-argue the Republicans on the right. So, if you're against a peace deal, then that makes you a very liberal Republican. When all the real conservatives are against any kind of conflict and want to support this thing. That's how you got to spin it. And you go, look at Bill Kristol and all the former Democrats, all the centrists, all the welfare statists, all the raise taxesists in the Republican Party, John McCain, the rhino, the liberal centrist Republicans. They're the ones who want conflict with Iran. Real conservatives oppose it. Real conservatives support Obama and his attempt to make a nuclear deal. That's not that hard, right? Go forth and spread the word, all of y'all. However many of y'all there are, I don't know. I have no idea how to estimate you. I've been podcasting for 10 years. I don't know how many you are. Maybe it's millions. Maybe it's 10. Judging by the phone calls coming in, there's nobody listening to the live show. If you exist and you're listening to this show live, you know, which would be 3 to 5 Eastern time on Friday, the 18th of October, 2013, then call in the show and say hi and tell me I'm stupid for thinking that Obama's smart enough or good enough at being a human man or anything else to make this deal. I want to hear it. I want to know. I do suspect that, by the way, myself. But I don't mean to put words in your mouth. 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. 877-513-0792. And anyway, again, if you're tuning in late, there you go. Barbara Slavin broke the story. She says she can't 100% verify. She's got a single source who's usually reliable. She didn't get to look at the whole PowerPoint or anything, but she's got some information. What says they'll freeze the 20% uranium enrichment and put to use the stuff that they already got. They will limit their enrichment to 3.6% at Natanz. They will convert the Fordo facility to a research facility. They will export their fuel from Iraq to another country where they could never make a bomb out of it from there. And they're only at, and they'll sign the additional protocol allowing expanded inspections. They will, and they're only asking the Americans to lift the sanctions that they know Barack Obama has the power to lift without congressional permission. Man, you better take them up on that. If that's accurate, then boy, oh boy, I'll tell you, that's good enough for me. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Hey, Charlie Walker. I listen every day I can, and I copy a lot of your things you say. It gets me into a lot of trouble, but...
Well, anyway, good times, man. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in, too.
Okay. All right, bye.
That's funny. Yeah, you know, well, he had a good attitude about it. But I wonder about that, you know, how many relationships I break. People from families full of warmongers who see the light and end up fighting with their family about it or breaking off old friendships. But you know what? It's not my fault. It's the war party that has led this society into this madness where decent people got to justify what's wrong. It ain't right that they do that to people, you know? Making good people justify what's wrong all the time. All right, anyway. I mentioned earlier about the cop that shot the guy. Thankfully, didn't kill him. At least he's in the hospital. He hadn't died yet, anyway, in Dallas, this guy. And the neighbor had the video camera running. And clearly the guy's just standing there and the cops shoot him because they can, because they're murderers. And they figure, oh, now's my chance. He's actually got a knife. I don't even need to break out my drop knife. So they kill him. But the neighbor had a security system. And he recorded it. And the guy is clearly just standing there. And the neighbor was standing there too. And he's sworn, looking right into the camera and obviously telling the truth to the local news. He didn't do anything. He's just standing there. They got out of their car, they saw him, and they just started shooting at him. And anyway, so that brings me to this other story, which is out of Minneapolis, that it's going to start as a pilot project, but they're moving rapidly to put cameras on all the cops. Now, what was the thing I was reading? I don't think it was the ACLU. It could have been the ACLU. It was the ACLU, actually, says one of my neurons, anyway. that had this thing about cop cameras. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. That had this thing about the cop cameras and about how, you know what, this is not perfect. And this is actually, you know, could be problematic in numerous ways with them going around filming people with, you know, who aren't doing anything wrong and they're now following under the surveillance of the cops. But its use for surveilling the cops themselves just outweighs that by too much. It has to be done. The cops must be forced to wear cameras on their glasses, on their hats, on their lapels, on their something with microphones. And it ought to be all broadcasted live by Wi-Fi 4G back to the home studio and locally recorded too, so that there's no buffering issues either. And people who are abused by the cops ought to have access to this. And now, maybe it's all a CIA plot to fool me or something, but it seemed to me that these results out of, San Dimas? Or is that even a real place, or is that just in Bill and Ted? Where were they at? I forgot the name of the town in California. Somewhere in mid-California, I think. Where these cops were made to wear cameras and the complaints for abuse went through the floor, right? Not just the, well, I mean, they never got in trouble for it, but people stopped even complaining about abuse. And so from the cops' point of view, everybody who loves cops, who's already right now on their belly listening to this show and you love cops, hey, from the cops' point of view, now that the people know that the cops have it all on camera, they don't bother lying about our heroic police officers anymore. Before, there was an epidemic of people lying about the heroic police. But now that the police can disprove it, no more of that. And then for the rest of you who are saying, who don't lick boots all day, what happened was the cops started behaving right. Because they knew that if they used force unjustly and the people complained against them, that there was an actual record made out of ones and zeros that could be reconstructed, which would reveal their abuse. And the cops hated it. The cops hated it. And one of the quotes of the cop was, oh, when, it's not fair. It's like George Orwell, Big Brother is watching you. Yeah, well, you're the police, dude. So, yeah, the boss is watching you. The boss being presumably under the bogus theory of popular sovereignty. What is this, communism or something? Supposedly the boss is being the people that you're the security force for, who hired the mayor and the council and the commissioner and whoever to oversee you as you go about your duties, simply enforcing the law, protecting lives and property. It's little brother watching the enforcers of the state, and the cops are crying their eyes out. Now, if I was a propagandist for putting cameras up everywhere, and if I was a mad genius, I guess I might have come up with that story just to convince people to want to put cameras on all the cops everywhere, but it rings too true to me. Doesn't that sound right to you? Every cop I've ever met from the time I was 11 on is, well, not every one of them. Actually, that one lady was nice. But the rest of them were such, eh. And I've had so many of them screaming in my face like they're my drill sergeant or whatever. From the time I was just a kid, that I'm of the conclusion that they're all a bunch of Nazis. They're all a bunch of murderers. And the ones of them who have never actually murdered anybody are just waiting for their chance. That's why they became a cop, so that they could kill somebody and not get in trouble. Because they're sick in the head and they want to exercise that power to feel what it's like to kill somebody. That's who they are. They're murderers. They're terrible people. And so it just rings true to me that they were tyrannizing the people of San Dimas or whichever. Somebody in the chat room, please correct me the name of this town. I don't want to Google it because I'm busy talking. The cops in that town, they hated it. And they stopped abusing people because they had to. Or at least they didn't stop. But the complaints against them were greatly reduced. And they're talking about doing this in Fort Worth. And now here they are, they're doing it in Minneapolis. In the midst of all this conversation, you have APD shoot a guy in the back of the neck, they say. I don't know how low on the neck it is before that's not shooting him in the back of the head, but... Well, there was a scuffle. The guy was completely innocent and was running from the cop who was stalking and hunting him. And so that's a crime. So he got shot in the back of the head. And, you know, as gruesome as it is, I'd like to see that video. I'd like the grand jury to see that video, but there is no video because the APD aren't forced to wear cameras. But, you know, I got to tell you, and this is just, it. You know what it is? Confirmation bias. The kind of people who are friends with me on Facebook are the kinds of people who hate cops, too. And so, if all my Facebook friends loved cops, I guess I would see stories all day about them helping kittens out of trees. But instead, what I see every day is cops kill some guy for no good enough reason anyway. They kicked in his door for no reason. They kicked in his door for not a good enough reason. He was standing there. He was laying there. He had a gun. He didn't have a gun. But they picked the fight. They killed the guy. It happens all the time. Radley Balco, who's America's expert on this, says that there are 150 to 200 SWAT raids every day. 150 to 200 SWAT raids. And then there are a lot of people killed by cops who aren't even SWAT cops. So, it's, you know, at least every day, I guess, or a few times a week or something, somebody gets shot by a cop for no good reason. No good enough one. And, you know, it is a changing world we live in with the total surveillance. You know, having cameras up everywhere is one thing. Having it all integrated into these super databases that can track us all is something else. And, you know, what it means to even exist in this society is a... And it's a different thing, and it's rapidly becoming much different. But... In one case where we can really use this technology back against them, it's local political pressure to put cameras on the cops. That is the best one. And especially every black civil rights leader in this country needs to get behind that. And, you know, I'm friends with the local NAACP head here in town, and I asked him about this, and he was intrigued and started looking into it. Rialto, California. Thank you very much. Rialto, California. There was a judge in New York who wanted to follow their lead. Thank you, Pat Max in the chat room. There was a judge in New York who the cops are screaming bloody murder that this judge wants them to wear lapel cameras there. Oh, how unfair for the NYPD. How are they supposed to live up to the quotas forced on them by their bosses if the victims are going to actually be able to review the evidence in court like that? That's not fair to the cops. They're screaming bloody murder about it. So it is problematic in its own way. More government surveillance of people. After all, these cameras are going to be pointed outward, right? It's not like they're going to make them wear a camera on a stick pointed back at them. Wouldn't that be nice? Anyway. Mostly these cameras are going to be looking at everybody who's not a cop, who's outside, or who's inside a place they raid. But it can be a powerful check on the way that they use their power. And in fact, I think especially if the SWAT cops are ever made to wear them and people really see what SWAT raids are like, and that kind of first person footage starts coming out that way, I think that, you know, it should be really good ammo, so to speak, for reformers in America who are trying to push and roll back the militarization of the police. And it's got to start on the local level where the people forbid the local government from accepting military equipment anymore, from acting in a paramilitary fashion anymore. It's absolutely got to stop. And you know what? I'm not a big believer in democracy, but it's okay to try to use it in self-defense a little bit. I got to live here, man. You do too. So I'm not saying turn yourself into Rand Paul or anything, but if there's a way that you can, you know, participate in local politics at the local level enough to try to push, to try to make this an issue, to try to make it, I mean, face it, the people arguing against you have to have no leg to stand on, right? You got to come out swinging. You got to have your arguments completely wired, and you got to figure out a way to take them on. Lord knows, I don't know. But you got to get the mayor on board for this thing, don't you? Am I wrong about that? It's too late for you to call now. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. I can see the controversy in it, but the cops, they just kill too many people. And being videotaped sucks, but being killed sucks worse. I don't know. I'm sure I'm right, except when I'm not, but it just seems like, when I saw the numbers there, for Rialto, 88% decrease in complaints against the cops. I mean, that just clinches it, right? Is that really right? Oh, by the way, the Pentagon lawyer who's been legalizing the assassination campaigns, including who has specifically argued in favor of the president's power to assassinate American citizens, is now going to be the director of Homeland Security. Did you see that? Jay Johnson? Man. Push back. You know what? I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, but you know who does is Michael Bolton over there. That guy has got, like, action programs for nullification and interposition from the county level on up. Go check him out at the 10th Amendment Center. And yeah, he paid me to say that. All right, see you on Monday. Thanks.